Hello there, history friends. Before we start this episode, I just want to say a huge thanks to you for supporting this show. I really, really appreciate it. And in case you forget what a great service you're doing for me, maybe you just listen to these episodes all in a bunch and you sometimes forget what is or what isn't Patreon stuff, I just want to say a huge thanks to you for making When Diplomacy Fails possible and for supporting me as I do this PhD as well. Having you guys in my corner is a huge boost to my confidence and my happiness, and it's nice to know that there's people out there who are just as nerdy about history and just as interested in Polish history as I am. So thanks so much, and enjoy this episode. And welcome, history friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode B, part 2, the story so far. Last time we introduced you to a turning point in Polish history, where the last truly Jagiellonian king of Poland died without heirs, and was succeeded by a handful of foreigners, before being succeeded by his sister's son, Sigismund, the Prince of Sweden. While on paper the linkage with Sweden seemed to hold many benefits, the major problem with the union proved to be the person of Sigismund, who for a time was King of Sweden and of Poland before being deposed in the former position. As a fundamentalist Catholic raised by the Jesuits, Sigismund's mission was to take back what was rightfully his, that being the Swedish crown, and to institute there the return of the Catholic Church. This mission, as we also saw, blinded him on another occasion too, when almost in spite of his leadership, Polish forces won a great victory in the Russo-Polish War and had Russia prostrate before its feet. Thanks to his unrealistic demands and religious fervour though, the Russian boyars determined it would be better to risk extinction than to give in to this Polish king. In short, Sigismund III had given his northern neighbours more than good cause to fear and loathe him and the ingrained power of his crown, which had been accumulating during the last few decades. In my view, it is impossible to explain the terminal decline in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth without looking at Sigismund's role in it, and that's why we spend a good deal of time with him in the last episode. Sigismund was succeeded by his son Vladislav in 1632, and up to 1648, this Vasa king continued his father's policies, though he did renounce his claim on the Russian throne, so at least there was that. Vladislav's 16-year reign was something of a reprieve from the conflict of the past, and his successes were sufficient to paper over the cracks which his father had caused. For this, Vladislav is to be commended, and he personally led the army several times during the Commonwealth's campaigns against the Russians in the Smolensk War of 1632-34, which the Commonwealth actually won. With that victory against Russia in his back pocket, Poland was also able to take advantage of Sweden's difficulties in 1635 to negotiate a very favourable peace deal, which would last 20 years. Vladislav even had time to wage a successful war against the Ottomans, and in the mid-1640s he gathered a force, made primarily of Cossacks, with the aim of striking against the Ottomans. Yet, Vladislav was very much like his father in this regard. In order to engineer a war against the Turk, he had bypassed the Commonwealth's Sejm and repeatedly gone behind the backs of influential magnates in the Senate. After so many years of his father ignoring their demands and rights, behaviour now copied by his son, the Senate and Commonwealth's nobility in general were in little mood to play ball in this war against the Turk, which could bring them, as far as these nobles could see, no discernible benefits. In Vladislav's mind, the endless raids against the Commonwealth border by Crimean Tartars and other Ottoman auxiliaries left him, in his view, no choice but to bring this war into the open and avenge these losses. In addition, by achieving success in another war, Vladislav believed he would be able to further solidify his position and guarantee the succession of his 7-year-old son, Sigismund Casimir, to the throne of Poland. Vladislav also believed that the Commonwealth was more than capable of conducting such a war, since it had avoided the ravages of the Thirty Years' War and was mostly untouched by the horrors which had scarred so much of the rest of Europe. The nobles, Vladislav would argue, were lazy and jealous of their money, and that was why they did not want to fight. This may well have been partially true, but the nobility were also sick of Vladislav's underhanded style of rule, and they could argue with some justification themselves that the only reason the Commonwealth was in good shape now was because they had overruled Vladislav's father when he had tried to enter the Thirty Years' War in favour of the Habsburgs. Nonetheless, the King of Poland pushed onwards and raised more troops each year until in 1647, something terrible happened. Vladislav's sole heir, Sigismund Casimir, died after a short fever, leaving the Polish throne with no Vasa heirs, save for Vladislav's half-brother, John Casimir, who had something of a wild upbringing and varied royal experience, being a prisoner of the French, a military leader, and even an outspoken critic of his half-brother and father on several occasions. With the death of his son, though, much of Vladislav's enthusiasm for war, in general, seemed to evaporate. There no longer seemed to be any point in pursuing the war, and he lacked the moral energy even to attend his child's funeral. We might expect this painful experience to have been good news in the long run, though, since surely this meant no war with the Turks, and thus no conflict between the king and the nobles. There was a problem, though, in simply calling the whole campaign off. I mentioned earlier that John Casimir recruited an army constituting mainly of Cossacks. Cossacks were the unruly and warlike vassal of the Polish crown. They lived mostly in modern-day Ukraine, but where this is important for us is that they'd been gathered together, they'd been recruited and summoned, with the expectation of war and booty being their rewards. Without the war, though, what were these Cossacks now to do? Amidst these questions came other troubles. The Commonwealth's relationship with its Cossack vassal had long been uneven and very tense, but now these tensions spilled into the open, as insult and mistrust rapidly led to open rebellion against the Polish crown. Worse than that, unusually for the Cossacks, they had themselves a strong leader, Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who was fiercely determined to acquire more rights and opportunities for his people at the Commonwealth's expense. Apparently caught completely unawares at this development, the Commonwealth's same dallied and failed to grasp the extent of the crisis, until this crisis became amplified when in May 1648, King Vladislav abruptly died. Now, not only was the Commonwealth facing down a revolt from a fierce and vengeful people on its border, it was also constitutionally paralysed until a new king was elected. In panic did many call for John Casimir, the late king's half-brother, to come to Krakow and receive the throne. But as ever, the inefficient, passionately guarded protocols for the election of a new king would first have to be respected. Many suspected that grave times were ahead, just as much of Europe was settling down to peace with the Peace of Westphalia, the Commonwealth seemed poised on the brink of an abyss. As bad as things seemed, though, nobody could imagine what awaited the Commonwealth over the next few decades. This is a long introduction, we haven't even played that gong sound yet, but it was a startlingly short road to disaster that Poland was headed down by the middle of the 17th century. After so many decades of resting on the laurels of its golden age, a great test was on the horizon, which the Commonwealth would need all its resources and powers to meet effectively. It is into this tumultuous set of circumstances which we now bring our narrative, as I take you to 1648. Understanding how the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth began its terminal decline in the middle of the 17th century is impossible without first understanding the position of the Cossacks within that Commonwealth. For several hundred years before the revolt led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky in 1648, Cossacks from the Ukraine had variably raided into the Crimea, attacked Ottoman targets, developed their identity along the River Dnieper, established their position within the Commonwealth, and fought both for and against that Commonwealth. At different times, Cossack bands could fight for or against Polish crown forces and on opposite sides of the battlefield. In the wilder eastern regions of the Commonwealth, law and order was in the hands of wealthier magnates, who often patrolled and held the region in security thanks to their employment of bands of Cossacks tied to their service. Across the border of this magnate's lands, Cossacks freed from such service could well engage in lucrative raids as Ukraine's grain stores remained favoured targets. Just as there was no unifying leader of the Cossacks, there was no single definition of what it meant to be a Cossack either. As the Ukrainian Sergei Plokhy wrote, "Who were the Cossacks? The answer depends on the period one has in mind. We know for certain that the first Cossacks were nomads. The word itself is of Turkish origin and, depending on the context, could refer to a guard, a freeman, or a freebooter. The first Cossacks were all of the above. They formed small bands and lived in the steppes outside local settlements and campsites of their hordes. Living off the steppe, they turned to fishing, trapping, and banditry." Another historian has defined Cossacks thus: "The Cossacks were not so much a people as a way of life. The very name, Cossack, derives from the Turkish Tartar word denoting a free soldier, and that just about defines their identity and semi-nomadic way of life. The spiritual home of the Cossacks of Western Ukraine, the Zaporizhian host, was the Sich, a commune ruled by elected leaders of the Zaporizh, the islands beyond the rapids of the River Dnieper. The population of the Sich was variable, as almost anyone could be a Cossack if he wished." Cossacks presented themselves as a warrior class, which remained on the move to the next opportunity for plunder or service, and always outside of the Commonwealth's tax bracket. One of the defining features of being a Cossack, indeed, was that you did not pay taxes to first the Grand Duke of Lithuania, and upon the Union of Lublin in 1569, which created the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, to the Commonwealth itself. This naturally made Cossack life attractive to indentured peasants, whose lives consisted of service to a magnate on his sprawling eastern estates. Cossacks could also be expected to live a far more interesting, albeit more dangerous, life than that of a peasant as well. In such a way, with this swashbuckling appeal, did the ranks of the Cossacks increase, and thus the idea of what it meant to be a Cossack became diluted. Peasants had moved to the eastern estates of the wealthy landed magnates during the 15th and 16th centuries. They were attracted there by the offer of tax-free incomes for a given period of years. These magnates were desperate to increase the population in their empty but enormous landholdings, but they did not count on what would happen once the peasant arrived and the period of tax-free living expired. The option of service in the Cossacks would mean a permanent uprooting of one's life, but it would also mean a sense of freedom to travel, to plunder, and to take what they wanted. When given the choice between essentially serfdom or Cossack service, peasants were by no means guaranteed to choose the option which would mostly guarantee their well-being, especially when we consider how otherwise hard and dangerous life in the border regions of the Commonwealth lands could be. Even if the peasant did not join up with a marauding Cossack band, there was always a terrifying chance that he could be captured during one of the many awful slave raids led by the fearsome Crimean Tartars. For this reason, for protection and security, Cossacks were often employed by these border magnates to police and protect the border regions and prevent any Tartars from entering into Commonwealth lands. But these Cossacks often proved happy to attack Tartars as much as Commonwealth citizens, especially when payment or booty was not forthcoming. To be fair, the Commonwealth had attempted to secure the Cossacks by bringing some kind of institutionalized order to the Cossack way of life. In the 1590s, efforts were made to transform the Zaporizhian Sich into an army which would serve the Commonwealth with a measure of reliability and loyalty. This was done by taking roughly 1,000 Cossacks and placing them on a register. This register was considered by the Commonwealth as the actual number of respectable Cossacks which the Commonwealth could count in the Ukraine, but more importantly for the Cossacks themselves, being on this register guaranteed you a paid salary in return for military service to defend the Commonwealth's borderlands. Where those wealthy magnates could not pay, here the state attempted to ease the burden of security for them. This scheme of placing Cossacks on a register and exchanging security for essentially livelihood enjoyed varying degrees of success. While it did create His Majesty's Zaporizhian Army, and while this army of Cossacks was immensely proud of its titles and entitlements, considering themselves among the elite of Cossack society, it did not prevent those more privileged Cossacks from conducting their own raids on their own targets. As time went on, the increase or decrease of this register would be used to placate or motivate the Cossacks and keep them in loyal bondage to the Polish crown. Yet, however large the register went, it went as high as 12,000 registered Cossacks just before Vladislav's death in 1648, the Commonwealth was never truly able to control the Cossacks or to engender among Cossack society any sense of loyalty to the Polish crown. What they remained loyal to was the leader who gave them the chance to plunder and enrich themselves, and King Vladislav, with his mission to attack the Turks, seemed to give them this chance, so the Cossacks proved surprisingly fond of him in return. Considering these uncertain, shaky circumstances upon which the life of a Cossack depended, we should not be too surprised that many were eager at the prospect of a lucrative war against the Ottomans, and then deeply angered when it emerged that this reliable source of plunder would not be forthcoming. Not only that, but with Vladislav dead, one of the few figures capable of bringing them into line was now gone, and the Commonwealth's remaining magnates in the wilder reaches, concerned for the safety of their estates, raised armies to bludgeon the Cossack into submission and disperse his forces. Since the Cossack register had climbed to 12,000 by this point, we imagine that this task would have been easier said than done for those magnates dealing with sparse resources and petrified levied troops. In a succession of skirmishes, the Cossacks routed the locally raised Commonwealth forces, with the result that by the end of 1648, the Ukraine was effectively in Cossack hands, the Commonwealth was powerless to seize it back, and the terrible combination of Tartar raids and Cossack skirmishes had led to a fatal weakening of the border areas. The devastation and atrocities committed by both Commonwealth and Cossack-Tartar sides wreaked havoc on the sparsely populated agricultural regions of the Commonwealth's east, and in addition led to food shortages, famine and disease sweeping across the region. Horrific orgies of violence followed, much of it religiously motivated, as scores of Jews, Catholics and Orthodox citizens were slaughtered in increasingly brutal ways, with impaling becoming a favourite method of execution. The troubled East was aching and scorched, but the following year the Poles rallied and scored several successes in spring 1649. This gave Bogdan Khmelnytsky pause for thought and made him contemplate a compromise peace under the Treaty of Zborov, which still granted him significant concessions. Several eastern Palatinates, provinces once ruled by Polish magnates, were now declared Cossack territory. There was even whispers of a third element in the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, that of a Ukrainian or Ruthenian character, but these whispers were quickly shot down the following year, as a terrible sign of things to come made its presence felt. In 1650, Bogdan Khmelnytsky accepted the overlordship of the Ottoman Sultan, who named him the vassal prince of the Ukraine, leader of the Cossack Hetmanate. This blatant Turkish interference and the resulting emboldening of the Cossacks was too much for Commonwealth sensibilities. The war with the Cossack was back on, and this time the Crown forces hit hard and fast, defeating the Cossack Tartar forces in the Battle of Berestechko in June 1651, and forced them to sign the Treaty of Biela Cerkva the following September. The peace treaty was, in the words of one historian, decidedly less favourable for the Cossacks. The Cossack register was reduced to 20,000. Khmelnytsky vowed to break off his Crimean alliance and to end his independent foreign policy, and the territory was once again open to Jewish settlement and the restoration of the noble landowning order. So perhaps things would be able to recover after all. The Commonwealth now seemed to be in the driver's seat and appeared to have finally put the rebellion of the Cossacks down. Yet, this was not to be. The Commonwealth's same was too divided on the issue of peace. Some desired to see the Cossacks put down and eliminated, literally exterminated, once and for all, rather than dealt with diplomatically as a separate entity. For this reason, the Treaty of Bela Tserkva was not actually passed by the Commonwealth's nobles, which meant that Bogdan Khmelnytsky was not bound by its tenets. Appreciating this, the Cossack hetman turned to the neighbours of the Cossacks, in the Tartars, Ottomans, and even the Russians, as he searched desperately for allies to use against the Commonwealth. As the historian Frank Sisson explains, it was at this point that Cossack and Commonwealth reached a diplomatic stalemate. Sisson wrote, "The Polish nobility did not want to return to the terms of Zabarov, and the Cossacks did not want to adhere to the Bela Tserkva agreement. With the Ukrainians concerned about the dependability of the Crimean Tartars and the realization that the Ottomans would not provide real support, they started to seek an alliance with Muscovy more seriously." And it is because Bogdan Khmelnytsky made this decision to seek help among Muscovy that understanding the Cossack problem is so fundamental to understanding what happened to the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth in the 17th century. With the Ottomans and Tartars distant, and with his own men desperate for more plunder, better terms with the Commonwealth, and better allies, Bogdan Khmelnytsky turned his wiles to securing an agreement with perhaps the last potentate many would have expected, and certainly the only figure he had really yet to actually ask for help, the Tsar of Russia. For the first time on such a scale, Russia became actively involved in the business of Poland-Lithuania. If this involvement can be measured as beginning in 1652, then it is arguably quite possible to state that this involvement never truly ended, and reached its apex 150 years later at the final Polish partition. Ever since Bogdan Khmelnytsky raised his standard of revolt against the Commonwealth, he had in fact been sending out feelers to whoever would listen. Of particular interest to us was his countless entreaties for Tsar Alexei of Russia to take the Cossack people under his high and lofty hand of protection, as it was said. Yet even while this offer must have been tempting, the Tsar refrained from accepting the Cossack entreaties for several reasons. First, Alexei was not certain if Bogdan's revolution would last, and he didn't want to engage in what could be a war with the Commonwealth for the sake of backing a losing horse. The Commonwealth and Russia had been at peace since 1634, and there was no need to break that peace if it granted the Tsar no benefits. Second, the Tsar was anxious to ensure that he did not become trapped in the same disrupting relationship with the Cossacks as the Commonwealth had been. Were he to sign on Bogdan's dotted line, there was no guarantee that the restless Cossacks would treat the Tsar with any more respect than they had treated the Polish king. Of course, in response to these concerns, Bogdan would assure the Tsar that their Orthodox faith bound them to a common Rus ancestry, and that it was the Polish king's Catholicism which made the current relationship between Cossack and Commonwealth so unpalatable to him. But Alexei could not be sure if this was gospel, or whether this was merely a front by Bogdan to lure him in and acquire guarantees. Third, and with regard to those guarantees, if the Tsar was going to absorb the Cossacks, he wanted to do so on his terms. He wanted the Cossacks to adhere to the Muscovite Confession of Orthodoxy, and he wanted the Russian protectorate over the Cossacks to be clearly stated and understood by both sides. Until these terms were met, the Tsar would not commit himself, and Bogdan did not wish to clarify these terms because they appeared too limiting to him and his interests. He continued to lead his Cossacks on several raids in Moldavia and the Crimea, but he knew his forces were in trouble deep down. The turning point in the negotiations between Cossack and Muscovite came then, not when Bogdan was ready, but when Bogdan was weakened enough to accept the Tsar's terms. It was only when a terrible plague of cholera ripped through Bogdan's camp, carrying off as much as 40% of his army and reducing his available effectives from 120,000 to 50,000, that Bogdan felt in a desperate enough position to adhere to the Tsar's terms. Because he knew of the Cossack hetman's desperation, Tsar Alexei knew that Bogdan was also less likely to betray him, or to try and weasel his way out of negotiations, and this belief was supported further by the knowledge that Bogdan had lost the opportunity to make new allies further afield. The Tsar would have been made aware that Bogdan Khmelnytsky's wide-ranging plans for alliance with the other minor princes, in the likes of Wallachia, Moldavia, and Transylvania had all broken down, while the Tartars were leaving his service as well as stripping the land bare. Not even among his own Cossack people could Bogdan Khmelnytsky claim to have absolute authority. Many minor Cossack leaders in other regions resented his power and were jealous of his position. They distrusted the people with which he had attempted to make deals as well. They broke off to form their own rival Cossack camps, many of which would ally themselves with the Polish. Dire as Bogdan Khmelnytsky's situation was, he had one last option open to him: throw himself and his people at the mercy, not of the Russian Tsar, but of the Ottoman Sultan. If he did that, then the Crimean Tartars would automatically become his allies, and the raiding by the Tartars in Cossack lands would stop as a result. Not only that, though, the Sultan's vast resources could be used to defend Cossack land. The Sultan would value an ally in the Ukraine, where Turkish ambitions for expansion had never dwindled, and he could be expected to render Bogdan every assistance. Thus, armed with the knowledge of Bogdan's melting armed forces, his lack of allies, and that final ruinous deal he could make with the devil, Tsar Alexei mobilized his diplomatic muscles to pull Bogdan in. Over the spring of 1653, the Tsar met with his council and discussed the wisdom in ending the peace with the Commonwealth, nearly 20 years after it had been made. Incidentally, in the tangled web of diplomacy which this region and its rulers produced, Bogdan Khmelnytsky actually preferred to place himself under the Tsar's protection rather than that of the Sultan. By keeping negotiations open with both, though, he could ensure that the Sultan continued to offer him better terms, while the Tsar would be inclined to rush to make a settlement out of fear that the Turk would seize the Cossacks and be done with it. As we've seen, even while Bogdan Khmelnytsky had no real right to, he was manipulating his betters, and the Tsar had indeed been persuaded that if he didn't act soon, the Cossacks would soon be lost forever and fixed to an alliance with the Tartars and Turks, which Muscovy would be hard-pressed to defeat. As before, though, just when Bogdan Khmelnytsky seemed to be somehow in control, everything went up in smoke. Over the summer of 1653, the Commonwealth's forces invaded the Ukraine and devastated Bogdan's plague-ridden army still further. Worse than this for Bogdan, his authority over his Cossack brethren had reached a low point, and he had proved unable to protect so many Cossacks and their families from enemies on all sides. To solidify his crumbling control over his forces, and to maintain as well a moral spiritual hold on the Orthodox Church which inspired his people, Bogdan was gradually compelled to make terms with the Tsar, and on the far more favourable terms that the Tsar had been waiting for. By this point in their history, the warhawks in Poland were winning the day and insisted that the Cossacks had been given one too many chances before and that they had to be properly subjugated or destroyed if the Commonwealth was to live in peace. With the Poles offering capitulation or death, Bogdan chose option C, and in the very controversial Pereyaslav negotiations in spring 1654, he allegedly placed the Cossacks and the Ukraine under Russian protection. The term allegedly is very important here, for several historians denote the controversial nature of the claim that the Ukraine placed itself unreservedly under the Tsar's protection at this point. 350 years later, it was still uncertain whether it was appropriate either to mourn or celebrate the anniversary of the agreement, and in 2004, much debate was had over the true legacy and intentions of each side. The vagueness of the actual agreement reached at Pereyaslav was made apparent when its articles were delivered to the Tsar on the 12th of March 1654. Immediately, the Tsar made clear his objections to Bogdan's demands to treat with foreign powers as he wished, for Russian troops only to garrison themselves in certain towns, and for Russian agents to refrain from interfering in Ukrainian civil life. Some equally vague compromises were given back, but war would help to clarify these complexities, largely because they grafted such a large level of power onto the Tsar's name by the end of the decade. In the short term, at least, the Tsar's commitment to the Cossacks strengthened Bogdan Khmelnytsky's hand, since Tsar Alexei gave the Cossacks what the Polish king had never agreed to: recognition of Cossack statehood, a Cossack register of 60,000, and privileged status for the Cossack estate, according to one historian. Tsar Alexei also promised to honour the previous arrangements which Polish kings had made to respect the liberty of the Cossacks, at least for now. More immediately for those dreamers within Bogdan's camp, the agreement with the Tsar established no western boundary for the Cossack territory. They could go as far as their sabres would take them. At this stage, the Tsar keenly needed the Cossacks to fight his battles in the Ukraine, for news of the agreement reached with the Cossacks forced him to resume the war with the King of Poland in July 1654, whereupon great raids were sent towards Smolensk in particular. Smolensk actually fell to the Russians in mid-September 1654, a loss which was felt bitterly on the Polish side, and which shortly rallied the nobles to action. King John Casimir knew that the Commonwealth had been greatly weakened by several years of conflict with the Cossacks, and the loss of this people in the war with Russia was sorely felt, even though an alliance with the Crimean Tatars had been signed, interestingly enough. Smolensk would never be Polish again, though, and its loss in September was not the shock that stunned the Commonwealth to action, but the first of many terrible defeats which signalled a terminal decline. For the last several years, the Commonwealth had been losing ground, first to the Cossacks and now to the Russians, and there was no guarantee that, to the north, the dynastic foe in Sweden would remain quiescent when the truce, from 1635, expired next year in 1655. Were the Swedes to invade in the north as the Poles battled Russians and Cossacks in the east and southeast, then catastrophe could very well follow. If King John Casimir of Poland feared for the implications of these developments, he could not have been ignorant to another development which had taken place in that other significant portion of the Commonwealth, in Lithuania. It was in Lithuania that Janos Radziwill, the influential nobleman who held the prestigious titles of Palatine of Vilnius and Grand Headman of Lithuania, was tasked with meeting the Cossack threat. The presence of Cossacks in Lithuania may seem strange, especially when we imagine that the Ukraine and Lithuania were two distant and very distinct states. How could it have been, we may wonder, that Cossacks travelled so far north, away from their Ukrainian home? Well, the presence of Cossacks in Radziwill's backyard of Lithuania was explained by two factors. First, Lithuania as a state once had stretched from the Black Sea to the Baltic and had counted the Cossacks among its subjects from medieval times. When the Union of Lublin created Lithuania and Poland in a Commonwealth, Poland inherited this Cossack problem from its once far-reaching partner. Second, the presence in Lithuania of Cossacks was explained by the ready availability of Cossacks for hire in border regions across the eastern portions of the Commonwealth. Cossacks were seen as a good option as paid settlers and mercenaries, since they could be depended upon to farm and defend the land. Of course, this relationship did not always produce the desired fruit, and Janos Radziwill found to his immense concern that the once settled Cossacks in eastern Lithuania had broken out in rebellion in support of their Cossack brethren further south. This story interests us because of how the Lithuanian Palatine reacted to the situation. Janos Radziwill had occupied several important fortresses in Lithuania to quash the Cossack revolt, but he never had enough forces at his disposal to completely eliminate the Cossack threat, and so the countryside remained dangerous. Failing to completely end the rebellion, Radziwill went much further, and seemed content to keep that rebellion in play for his own dynastic interests. So long as the Polish crown forces were distracted, he, as a Calvinist, could see to it that his family and his religious brethren's benefits were expanded and consolidated. Any concerns raised in Poland were silenced by Radziwill's effective use of a device which we are soon to be made very familiar with indeed, the Liberum Veto. The Liberum Veto was a right granted to all Commonwealth nobles to halt legislative proceedings at any point they saw fit by offering a single objecting voice. Radziwill used it essentially to keep his hold on Lithuania and maintain at least a background Cossack menace in Lithuania too, which would be enough to scare recalcitrant Lithuanian nobles into line. So what are we to make of this examination of these tumultuous years in Polish history? within this 7-year period, we've seen the Commonwealth buckle in the face of a strong revolt, relinquish its hold over the Cossacks in the southeast, and then enter into a conflict with Russia from an exhausted, disadvantageous position. We've also seen a theme about Polish history, which we will keep revisiting throughout the series of Poland Is Not Yet Lost, that in order to tell the story of Poland properly, and to put that story in context, we also have to understand what Poland's neighbours were doing. This isn't always an easy task, and it can often result in us going on tangents to fill in gaps of the story, which become important later on. It means that telling the story of Poland is a more complex task than you may have been expecting. Out of necessity, we won't be focusing our attention purely on Poland. Russians, Ottomans, Swedes, French, Austrians, Prussians, and so many more polities and peoples come under our radar in this series, because just as surely as these groups had a part to play in shaping the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, they also had their own roles to play in its eventual disappearance. Sometimes in the course of this series in the future, it may seem as though I'm going too far from the story, or that I'm ignoring Poland to talk about the King of Sweden, the Tsar of Russia, or the Habsburg Empress. But I do assure you, all of the interconnected elements of the story of Poland will be drawn together in time. And after all, guys, part of the joy in this story is pulling all of these apparently disparate strands together and making a historical tapestry, as I like to call it, which is both enjoyable to listen to and properly complete. Because of your grounding in these years of Polish history, you will be better equipped to understand where the Cossacks fit in, why the Russians were at war, and when the cracks began to appear in the Commonwealth. In case you weren't aware, it is in this episode that these cracks began to appear in the foundations of that republic. In the next episode, we will see these cracks have dynamite shoved into them, and the whole edifice, the entire structure, will seem to implode before our very eyes. If you don't know what's coming next, then to give you a hint, the Swedish king was coming. He was about to break the truce in 1655, and he was about to deliver a nightmare to Poland, which she hadn't felt since, arguably, the arrival of the Mongols at the gates of Warsaw in the 13th century. The rebellion of the Cossacks continued, and the war with the Tsar was just beginning, but the Swedish deluge, that cataclysmic event in Polish history, was fast approaching. Next time I will be telling this story and concluding our 3-parter on the history of the Commonwealth up to 1700. I hope you've enjoyed this episode, history friends and lovely patrons, and you'll join me for the next one. But for now, my name is Zach, and you've been listening to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, Episode B, Part 2, the story so far. Thanks so much for listening and supporting us, guys, and I'll be seeing you all soon.